Umsadadje Ungwahuwen Ahadi Wanodas, Nene Aboriginal Voices, Oska Dewanyawar Oska, Ne Jota FM CFRC.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
So the reason I resigned is I was really just tired of writing about the violence and what was going on in Gaza and just having nobody take any action on it, completely disregarding what I was saying. Our policies there are immoral, illegal, and just in total contradiction of U.S. interests, and I couldn't be a part of that anymore.
In one of his first TV interviews, we'll speak with career U.S. diplomat Michael Casey. He resigned in July from the State Department over U.S. policy in Gaza, but just recently went public with his reason. Then to Damascus for an update from Syrian journalist and BBC Middle East correspondent Lena Sinjab. She's returned to Syria after she was forced to flee due to threats from the Assad regime. And a damning new investigation by the Washington Post finds more than 3,100 indigenous students died at boarding schools in the U.S. between 1828 and 1970, three times the number of deaths reported earlier this year by the first ever Native American cabinet member, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland.
Tens of thousands of indigenous children as young as 4 years old were taken from their families and communities and forced into boarding schools run by the U.S. government and religious institutions. These federal Indian boarding schools have impacted every indigenous person I know.
We'll speak with the Washington Post Native American journalist Dana Hedgepeth, who led the investigation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian health officials say Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip have killed 38 people and injured 137 others in the past 24 hours. Among the dead are five journalists with the Al-Quds Today channel who were killed in an Israeli strike on their broadcasting van near the Al-Ada hospital in the Nusayrat refugee camp. Video of the attack shows a van clearly marked with the word press engulfed in flames. The slain journalists, Fadi Hassouna, Ibrahim Al-Sheikh Ali, Mohammed Al-Ada, Faisal Abu Al-Kumsan, and Ayman Al-Jari, who had gone to the Al-Ada hospital with his wife in labor with their first child. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate reports Israeli attacks since October 2023 have killed more than 190 journalists and media workers across Gaza. Meanwhile, Palestinian doctors say three babies have died of hypothermia in recent days as temperatures in Gaza's tent encampments plummet amidst Israel's stifling blockade of food, water, and aid. Displaced Christians in Gaza marked a somber Christmas holiday amidst the devastation. This is 67-year-old Najla Tarzi, whose family once again spent Christmas sheltering inside Gaza's only Catholic church.
Each year on this date, we celebrate the birth of Jesus, spread joy to children, pray at night, and celebrate Jesus' coming and birth. Last year was very harsh on us, and this year is harsh with the atmosphere of war, martyrs, and the life we're living. We can't handle it. We don't know how to describe it. It's extremely difficult. It is misery.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed at least eight Palestinians Wednesday as Israeli troops backed by armed drones attacked the Tulkarm and Nur Shams refugee camps. Among those killed were two Palestinian women and an 18-year-old. Ukraine's military says it shot down 20 out of 31 drones launched by Russia in overnight attacks. One of the drones struck a market in the Ukrainian town of Nikopol, injuring eight people. That followed a wave of Russian attacks on Christmas, targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure, which left hundreds of thousands of people in Kharkiv without power or heat in freezing winter temperatures. There were also blackouts in the capital, Kyiv, where some residents spent Christmas sheltering and underground subway stations.
I am scared because I have a child. Of course, I want to be at home and celebrate. We had to shelter because it's scary to stay at home. So we came to the shelter. We want peace.
In the central Ukrainian city of Kryvyi Rih, one person was killed, 15 others injured Wednesday, when a ballistic missile fired by Russia struck their apartment building. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky condemned the attacks as inhuman. Meanwhile, the governor of Russia's North Ossetia region says a woman was killed at a shopping center in the city of Vladikavkaz when falling debris from a Ukrainian drone that was shot down triggered an explosion and fire. In Kazakhstan, 38 passengers were killed Wednesday when an Azerbaijani airliner with 67 people on board crashed near the city of Aktau. 29 survivors were hospitalized. The passenger jet had been en route from the Azerbaijani capital of Baku to the Russian city of Grozny when it veered hundreds of miles off its scheduled route before crashing on the opposite shore of the Caspian Sea. A Russian civil aviation official said a preliminary investigation revealed a bird strike led pilots to attempt to divert the flight. But a Ukrainian official said Russia had used a surface-to-air missile system to shoot the plane down after mistaking it for a Ukrainian drone. That claim was bolstered by footage from the crash site appearing to show shrapnel damage to the plane's tail section. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has threatened to bury Kurdish fighters in Syria unless they lay down their arms. Erdogan made the threat during remarks to the Turkish parliament Wednesday, insisting the Kurdish YPG militia must disband.
As I said after the cabinet meeting, business as usual is no longer possible. The separatist murderers will either bid farewell to their weapons or be buried in Syrian soil alongside their weapons.
On Monday, thousands of women rallied in the northeastern Syrian city of Qamishli, demanding Syria's new leaders respect women's rights. They also condemned Turkish-backed attacks on Kurdish groups. Many of the protesters waved the green, yellow, and red flags of the Women's Protection Units, an affiliate of the Kurdish People's Protection Units militia that Turkey considers a terrorist organization.
Today, all women in the Jazeera region, including Kurds, Arabs, and Syriacs, are uniting their voices, saying yes to supporting the Women's Protection Units, YPJ, yes to preserving the rights and gains of the women's revolution in northern and eastern Syria. Today, we are safeguarding all the achievements of northern and eastern Syria by demanding freedom and rights for all women without discrimination.
Later in the broadcast, we'll go to Damascus for an update from the Syrian journalist, BBC Middle East correspondent Lina Sinjab. In Mozambique, dozens of people have been killed in clashes with police after opposition parties rejected the results of a presidential election that protesters claim was rigged by the governing party. Human rights groups have accused security forces and police of excessive force, at times firing live rounds at protesters. On Monday, Mozambique's top court upheld the election victory of Daniel Chapo of the ruling Frelimo party. Mozambique's main opposition leader, Venancio Mondlane, rejected the outcome and declared he'll install himself as president January 15th.
This Christmas, while the people are being massacred, while the people are being killed, while the people are being humiliated, what Christmas are we going to have? Yes, we're going to have Christmas. We've already said that our Christmas is Mozambique. It's going to be on the streets.
Meanwhile, more than 1,500 prisoners on Wednesday escaped the Maputo Central Prison, where guards killed 33 prisoners and wounded 15 others as they attempted to hold back the jailbreak. Authorities later said they'd recaptured about 150 prisoners. In Haiti, two journalists and a police officer were killed Tuesday when gunmen opened fire on a news conference in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Several others were wounded in the Christmas Eve attack, which left reporters Mackenzie Nathu and Jimmy Jean dead. Media workers had gathered to interview Haiti's new health minister at the reopening of the Port-au-Prince's biggest public hospital, which has been closed for much of the year amidst a surge in violence. And here in the United States, a federal judge has struck down key portions of an Arkansas state law that would have allowed prosecutors to bring criminal charges against booksellers or librarians for providing minors with access to so-called harmful materials. Offenders faced up to a year in prison. U.S. District Judge Timothy Brooks ruled the law violated the First and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, writing, quote, "The law deputizes librarians and booksellers as the agents of censorship. When motivated by the fear of jail time, it's likely they'll shelve only books fit for young children and segregate or discard the rest," unquote. The ACLU of Arkansas celebrated the ruling, writing, quote, "This was an attempt to thought police, and this victory over totalitarianism is a testament to the courage of librarians, booksellers, and readers who refuse to bow to intimidation," they said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Gaza, where medics say an Israeli strike killed five journalists who worked for Al-Quds TV in the Nuseirat camp in central Gaza. They were reportedly sleeping in a van, clearly marked with the word press. Meanwhile, three Palestinian babies have died of hypothermia at the Al-Mawasi refugee camp in southern Gaza as temperatures plummet and Israel's deadly blockade on food, water, and key winter supplies continues. The father of three-week-old victim, Sila Mahmoud Al-Fassi, told Al Jazeera his family had been sleeping on cold sand in a tent exposed to bitter winds. Al-Mawasi is designated a safe zone, but Israel has repeatedly attacked it over the last 14 months as its forces continue to pound Gaza. This comes as Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank raided Nablus to escort a group of settlers to Joseph's tomb, which has been a flashpoint between Palestinians and Israeli settlers.
A group of Palestinian Americans trapped in Gaza has sued the Biden administration, saying it abandoned them and their families in a war zone despite rescuing, quote, similarly situated Americans of different national origins, unquote. For more, we're joined by Michael Casey. He resigned from the State Department in July over U.S. policy on Gaza after a 15-year career in the Foreign Service. He served 9 years before that in the U.S. Army. He was deputy political counselor at the United States Office for Palestinian Affairs in Jerusalem for 4 years before resigning. He's joining us now from Michigan. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mike Casey. So you resigned in July. You're making the reasons for your resignation public now. Explain what happened and why you've decided to leave your career.
True, and first of all, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I've been trying to get the story out, honestly, since I left. I've talked to sort of multiple journalists who, you know, for various reasons weren't able to publish a story until recently. So I've been trying to get the story out since that time. And really, you know, why I left was that after I covered Gaza almost every day for 3 years and just writing every day about what was happening there, even before October 7th, the humanitarian catastrophe that was there beforehand, and just getting no action from Washington on any of those issues. And we also, my office wrote about Palestinian politics, settlements, human rights issues, prisoner abuses, different things like this every day writing about them. And then October 7th, everything was just amplified, you know, 100 times worse than it was before. And just writing all this information, having it disregarded, taking no actions and no policies on it, and acting constantly in direct contravention of our own interests was eventually too much for me. And I decided I had done everything I could to help. There was nothing more I could do on the inside, and it was time for me to leave.
And Mike, you've said, in fact, that once you were posted in Jerusalem, everything you learned as a diplomat, you had to forget. If you could elaborate on what you mean by that.
Sure. It's just, and that's the way it feels. You know, basic things as a diplomat to be skeptical of your interlocutors. You know, when the government of the country you're assigned to tells you something, you have to fact check it a little bit. But with the Israeli government, we don't do that. We just repeat what they tell us. We don't even report on that information. And, you know, and having basic concerns for issues like human rights, that it was a bedrock of our foreign policy in other places. And in Israel, we just completely disregard it. I mean, one issue I always highlight was administrative detention, which is where people are locked up without charges. You know, when I was in other countries like Malaysia, there was maybe one person in admin detention, and the Secretary of State would raise her case all the time. Whereas in Israel, we were approaching 2,000 Palestinians were in being held in admin detention, including minors, including American citizens, and we never said a word about it. And so just these issues that you would normally push forward everywhere else in this country, we just pretend like it's not a problem.
So in your reading, Mike, you worked at the State Department. Before that, you were also in the military. What, in your view, explains this? Why do you think the U.S. is consistently blind to the suffering of Palestinians?
It's hard to get a concrete answer on that as to why that is, just seeing it happen every day and what we do with that and just the absolute disregard of reality that we have. And it's good to see organizations like Dawn who are launching a lawsuit. It's sad that it had to come to this point, but launching a lawsuit against the State Department for violating its own policies, you know, violating its own human rights reports, as they mentioned when they made the announcement, because my office wrote these reports and documented the human rights abuses there. It was the longest report in the world. It took the longest to finish. And then we come out and say things like there are no human rights issues in Israel. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. And as to why that is, I don't know. Our policy is just completely backwards. We start from the point of we need to sell weapons to Israel, and then we backtrack and make the facts the way we need it to be in order to make that happen, which is the exact opposite of what we should be doing.
I wanted to go to a clip from the Fault Lines documentary called Starving Gaza in Al Jazeera English that features Stacey Gilbert, who we also interviewed, the former senior advisor in the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration. She resigned after over 20 years in service after disagreements with a State Department report that she worked on, concluding Israel was not obstructing U.S. humanitarian assistance to Gaza.
In April, Stacey Gilbert was asked for her input on a Biden administration report on whether Israel was committing war crimes in Gaza.
I was shocked to see that it said, in very clear terms, it is our determination that Israel is not blocking humanitarian assistance.
You had advised that that wasn't the case, is that correct?
Yes. The subject matter experts were removed, and the report was moved up to a higher level. We were told you will see the report when it is released publicly.
And then the report comes out and just doesn't include what you had to say?
I wasn't sure I read that correctly. I read it again, and I sent an email then that I would resign as a result of that.
Do you remember what you wrote in your resignation email?
I said that report will haunt us.
That's Stacey Gilbert, a State Department official in the Al Jazeera documentary Starving Gaza. You can also go to Democracy Now! To see our extended interview with Stacey. So, Mike Casey, that was in the spring. You were there in Jerusalem. You were still working. Talk about the changing of the conclusions of this report, which Stacey Gilbert said is a report that will haunt us.
And she's absolutely correct, because it's absurd to reach that conclusion based on all of the evidence that's out there. I mean, it's the absolute consensus of the international organizations, human rights organizations that are actually in Gaza and documenting this information. And the decision comes in complete contrast to that. And there's no one out there who is saying the situation is not that Israel is allowing aid. And no one is saying that except for the Israeli government. So when we reach these conclusions, we're either using information provided by the Israelis or we're simply making it up, because no credible organization is saying that they are not blocking humanitarian aid.
I want to go to the funeral of Shireen Abu Akleh. She was killed by an Israeli sniper outside the Jenin refugee camp, one of the most well-known Al Jazeera reporters. She was killed May 11th, 2022. After she was killed, there was a funeral for Shireen. Can you describe, Mike Casey, you were in Jerusalem at the time, is that right? Can you describe what happened at the funeral? She is, by the way, an American journalist, a Palestinian American journalist.
Yes, I was there at the time, and it was, you know, it was one of the worst days in the office when she was killed and then when the funeral happened, because it was just so emblematic of our policies there and our policy failures that an American is going to be killed. We're going to call for an investigation. We're not going to be serious about it. Whatever they come out with, we're going to accept, even if we know the facts or otherwise. And then it reaches the point where her funeral is attacked. The police are beating pallbearers. Her coffin falls on the ground. And we don't say anything about it, just that this level of brutality that's happening, and we don't say anything. And so people in the office were just devastated emotionally, because many of them knew her personally. And then knowing that they're working for the United States government, who has the most leverage and the most ability to make some changes and make some impact, and know that we're not going to say anything about it. And it was really crushing for morale in the office.
I mean, you have senators like Maryland Senator Van Hollen, who have called for the release of the report on Shireen Abu Akleh. That actually hasn't happened. And if you can compare what took place there and what you felt should have been said by the United States, and how the U.S. deals in other countries.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was listening to the headlines at the beginning of your broadcast, just to hear the update on Gaza and the update on Ukraine, and seeing, you know, two incidents, and we're going to have very different responses to them, because we simply pick and choose our statements that we're going to make depending on the situation. So it's just that we're going to put red lines out there. We're going to call for investigations. We're going to do things like that in Israel, but we're not serious about it. And we're not concerned with the result that comes out from them.
Well, I want to go to some of the early work that you did shortly after October 7th, 2023. Just 3 weeks into Israel's bombardment of Gaza, nearly 7,000 Palestinians had already been killed. But on October 25th of 2023, President Biden cast doubt on Gaza's official death toll. This is a clip of Biden.
I have no notion that the Palestinians are telling the truth about how many people are killed. I'm sure innocents have been killed, and it's the price of waging a war.
So, Mike, if you could explain, what was your response when you heard Biden's remarks?
So we fought within the system to clarify why we believe those numbers were the most accurate numbers we could find. You know, we had an official response that we would talk about how the Ministry of Health in Gaza is the most connected to its parent ministry in Ramallah. Many of the employees there from the PA, analyses of past conflicts have never shown a significant difference between the reports. So we had an official way of dealing with it. But in general, it was sort of personally affected me, because I was writing those numbers every day in our reports at the time. And when the President of the United States comes out and says, I don't believe your numbers, that's a little bit hard to deal with. But in general, it was a common trend even before October 7th that we don't believe Palestinian sources of information. We don't believe what they say, whether it's Palestinian government, whether it's Palestinian contacts that we talk to. It's just disregarded. And even the United Nations and others, we disregard sometimes. We will accept the Israeli narrative over all others, even if we know it's not correct.
So can you explain, Mike, we just heard earlier from Stacey Gilbert, how many of your colleagues do you believe, whether they resigned or not, how many of your colleagues in the State Department agree with you and others in criticizing U.S. policy on Israel-Palestine? And in particular,
it's
now, in the wake
sentiment.
Of the war, the assault on Gaza.
It's a very strong sentiment within the department. I've had many people reach out to me, you know, saying they support what I did. They're glad I'm speaking out, essentially giving them a voice to their concerns that they have. And a lot of people who have told me they would be right behind me if it weren't for, you know, their own personal circumstances that they can't resign, which I fully respect in that. So it's definitely a common sentiment, especially at the lower levels within the department. It was always surprising. Everyone that I talked to, everyone I interacted with, it seemed like everyone felt the same. Yet somehow, like Stacey mentioned, when the information goes up to a higher level, the decision that comes back down is completely opposite of what everyone's put forward.
So you're talking about Tony Blinken. You're talking about the Secretary of State. When you say when it goes up to a higher level or the people around him, how much contact did you have, or was there any discussion that you had or others you know had with him? For example, Gilbert saying they changed the results of their report when saying everyone knew Israel was stopping humanitarian aid from getting in, and yet that was changed.
That's never been fully clear. Where does that decision happen in the department? Once it goes above maybe the assistant secretary level, where are those changes made? Who makes those final decisions? That I don't know. I don't have full clarity on that. I did have interactions with Secretary Blinken when he would come to visit. You know, I arranged some of his meetings. I sat in some of his meetings as a note taker when he met with President Abbas and others. And you know, out of all the decision makers at the top, the Secretary of State was one of the most disappointing ones, because he seemed to be an individual who was very smart, understood the conflict, had a level of empathy. You know, when we got our local staff out of Gaza, you know, he called each of them to check in on them. So he seemed to have a level of empathy and understanding of the situation, yet he's backing these decisions at the higher level. So out of all the people at the top that are involved in this, he was one of the most disappointing to me personally.
And Mike, could you talk about what within the State Department, what the response has been to these protests? After you resigned, you and three others got an award for constructive dissent from the American Foreign Service Association for a cable you wrote about Gaza. Could you explain what was in that cable? What is a dissent cable?
So a dissent cable is a special channel where you can write a report saying, I disagree with whatever policy we're working on. You can't put that sort of information in standard reporting, but you can put it in the dissent channel, which stays very protected. It goes up to the higher levels of the State Department. They do read and they do respond to it and address those issues. When we won the award, we actually had to look back at our dissent cables because we wrote more than one to figure out which one they were talking about in particular. A lot of the details I don't want to get into for sort of reasons of classification. The overall question was that we need to do more to evacuate people from Gaza. You know, we evacuated American citizens out of Gaza, but then we just stopped and we were not evacuating people who we had worked with over the years, people that, you know, had been contacts of ours, people we'd sent on exchange programs, people we had invested in, people who were the future of Gaza that really need to be helped and protected, not just for humanitarian reasons, but really for what's going to happen in Gaza in the future. And so we basically wrote a dissent cable about that, which obviously didn't change the policies there, particularly after Rafah was shut down.
So, Mike Casey, can you talk about the last straw for you? You were in Jerusalem, one of the top State Department officials there, when the National Security Council said they should just back what Israelis want for post-conflict Gaza. Explain what you understand that is and why you left.
So that was one area, as things were moving forward in Gaza, that I stayed a little bit longer thinking this is one area where maybe we can make a positive impact, is really laying out what needs to happen in the future in Gaza. And we laid out, you know, a plan that involved the humanitarian aspects of it, security aspects of it, governance aspects of it, what needs to happen in terms of connecting Gaza with the rest of Palestine, you know, inserting a credible Palestinian government at the governor, ministerial, and local level, in integrating that, you know, creating a second state, two-state solution, everything like that that would fit within our goals and what's best for Gaza. And the response was, well, the Israelis have a different plan, and we're just going to go with that.
And
the current plan
is
the idea of, the current plan is, I understand it, was having local families, they use the term clans, to run things in Gaza. And we wrote reports about why that's not feasible, it's not going to work, and that the reason the Israelis support that plan is because it would lead to chaos and conflict in Gaza, which is their goal in what is happening there. It's not our goal. It shouldn't be. And it's not a feasible plan. And I've talked to contacts of mine in Cairo who said even just a couple weeks ago, people from Washington were still reaching out to them and asking about this plan. So it seems we're still pursuing it, even though we know it's not feasible and it's not right.
And Mike, finally, as we end, if you could talk about what your concerns are about the incoming Trump administration with respect to U.S. policy on Palestine. He said earlier this month that if the Israeli hostages are not returned by Inauguration Day, that is January 20th, quote, all hell is going to break out.
And unfortunately, I'm not optimistic about an incoming administration. I fear they're going to basically pick up where they left off in terms of where the Israeli government was planning to formally announce or annex settlements in the West Bank and other destructive policies, which are not only terrible for Palestinians, but also very difficult to reverse in a future administration. And so I fear they're going to pick up where they left off. I feel Israel is going to be given even more of a blank check than they have under the Biden administration, and that there will be steps taken, like annexation of certain areas, that the Trump administration doesn't understand the impact of those because they don't analyze them very carefully and simply just accept whatever Israel wants them to do, even more so than the Biden administration. But if I were to give them advice, I would tell them to really focus on having a policy on Palestine, not just viewing it through the lens of Israel and what Israel wants, but what's good for Palestinians, what's best for our own interest there. If we want a two-state solution, we need to create a second state. We can't just put Palestine in quotes and reports and pretend like it doesn't exist. We need to create a political, economic, social, cultural entity that is Palestine, recognize the country, stop denying its existence at the United Nations and others, and really push forward policies such as a national election and different things like that that are important for the Palestinian people, regardless of what the impact is on Israel.
Michael Casey, we want to thank you for being with us. Mike resigned from the State Department in July after a 15-year career in the Foreign Service. He was deputy political counselor at the United States Office for Palestinian Affairs in Jerusalem for 4 years before resigning in July over U.S. policy on Gaza. Coming up, we go to Damascus for an update from the Syrian journalist, BBC Middle East correspondent Lena Sinjab. Stay with us.
You took me by the hand, we walked through the sand, and you held me in the waves. The sea was open, now I'm broken up. Sister of the sea, you knew me, and I knew you to be free. You howled with the moon and the sun, he rose too soon over you, my sister of the sea.
Sister of the Sea by Maggie Clifford. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the latest developments in Syria in the wake of the fall of Bashar al-Assad's regime earlier this month. On Wednesday, the first widespread demonstrations took place in cities across Syria after a widely shared video showed an attack on an Alawite shrine in the north. Syria's new rulers said the video was old and had been shared to, quote, stir up strife. Al-Assad belonged to the Alawite sect.
This comes as thousands of women rallied Monday in the northeastern Syrian city of Qamishli, demanding Syria's new leaders respect women's rights. They also condemned Turkish-backed attacks on Kurdish groups. Many of the protesters waved the green, yellow, and red flags of Women's Protection Units, an affiliate of the Kurdish People's Protection Units militia that Turkey considers a terrorist organization.
Today, all women in the Jazeera region, including Kurds, Arabs, and Syriacs, are uniting their voices, saying yes to supporting the Women's Protection Units, YPJ, yes to preserving the rights and gains of the women's revolution in northern and eastern Syria. Today, we are safeguarding all the achievements of northern and eastern Syria by demanding freedom and rights for all women without discrimination.
For more, we go now to Damascus, where we're joined by Lena Sinjab, a Syrian journalist and BBC Middle East correspondent. She was the BBC Syria correspondent until 2013, when she was forced to flee Syria after threats from the Assad regime. She's been reporting from Beirut for over a decade and returned to Syria earlier this month as the Assad regime was collapsing. Lena, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you start off by just describing the scene in Damascus this week and also talk about what happened around Christmas?
Well, I have to say that it's been over 2 weeks since the toppling of Assad regime, and there's still a sense of freedom and joy among many Syrians, whether here in the capital or elsewhere in the country. It's a heavy burden that has been, over the shoulders of Syrians for nearly five decades, and the last decade was the worst as they faced detention, bombing, and, torture inside the prison, disappearances. So I think many Syrians are still in the overwhelmed feeling of freedom, feeling that they belong to the country, that they have a say in the country, and that they are able to contribute to the future of Syria.
And Lena, if you could talk about your own experience as a Syrian. You returned after so many years away, and you said when you crossed over, you were in Lebanon and you came into Syria. You said upon your return, quote, "This is the first time ever in my life as a journalist that I'm fearless." So could you elaborate on that?
Well, I've been reporting on Syria for a long time. I joined the BBC in the mid-2000s and continued reporting up until the time that I had to flee the country in 2013. And there was always the pressure of what to say, who to talk to, what permission you take, who's the minder who's going to accompany you whenever you're reporting. You know, you always have these two minds. You want to maintain your integrity and impartiality as a journalist, tell the truth, but also try to find a way so that you're not, you know, falling into the hands of the regime's repression. And I've had many cases where I've been called in, I've been summoned, I've been, you know, grounded because of reports that I've done. But when the uprising began, I just like felt there is no way of hiding the truth. I had to report on the peaceful protesters, on their peaceful demands. I had to report on the opening fire on protesters, on the detention, on the killing. And, you know, I was stopped several times by regime forces and different security forces, sometimes picked up from a park near my home, sometimes from the border, sometimes from a demonstration in the suburbs of Damascus. But I ended up in the last year, like, confined to my house. I wasn't able to go out or report, you know, on the ground. I had to be constantly on the phone talking to people that I've trusted. I know for sure that they're telling me the truth and broadcast from my home. I was under, you know, country arrest. I wasn't able to travel outside Syria. But I had, you know, tried my best so that I leave the country without, you know, violating any, you know, rules, because I didn't want to provoke my right to come back. However, you know, the threats continued even when I was outside. Several times I was like put on the arrest list by different you know, security police. And, you know, even if you are outside the country, you are always thinking of the ones you left behind, of family members, of friends who might be getting trouble. People continue talking anonymously even when they are outside Syria because they're afraid about their freedom, their, you know, families, their safety. So that's all is gone now. I feel for the first time we are in Syria, we don't have worries about where to go, who to talk to. Actually, even if you walk in the streets, people come up to you because they want to tell their stories, they want to share their stories. And one thing that is really incredible to see for my own eyes in my own country is over the past years when I managed to bribe my way in and come here, I felt that this country has become dark and with heavy shoulder, that people have grown old with sadness and with poverty. Now there are big smiles on their faces, their shoulders are upright, their heads are up. They feel that, you know, they're liberated and, you know, they're proud of where they are today, and that's a big difference.
So, Lina, I mean, in addition to this, you know, what you describe, how Syrians are feeling this celebratory mood, there's also a great deal of mourning for the hundreds of thousands who were disappeared or killed during Assad's regime. So if you could say a little bit about that, what you've learned about the missing, how many there are, and what's been revealed of these mass graves, the prisons, the prison network, the vast prison network that Assad ran.
You know, the detention haven't started during Assad the son, but actually Assad the father. And there were many reports about former prisons, whether Palmyra or even Saidnaya in the old days of the father, where, you know, people were even killed using acid to melt their bodies. When the uprising began in 2011, protesters would pray for their families, to pray for them that they will get a bullet and get killed rather than get detained, because they know what detention means. And thousands of people disappeared over the years. You know, recently the Syrian Human Rights Organization, you know, we're talking about over 120,000 missing in Syrian prison, forcibly disappeared. While the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that over 60,000 were tortured to death inside prison. That's all before prison cells were open to the public and some prisoners were released. At that point, Syrian Human Rights Organization came to the conclusion that yet another 80,000 or more have been tortured to death. And then we came to the discovery of the mass graves, and many, you know, organizations who've been documenting and studying from, you know, satellite images, the situation of the mass graves, they're estimating that nearly 300,000 have been tortured to death. So, you know, the number of people who disappeared, like, or tortured to death, is really high in numbers. And that leaves many families who are wanting answers and, you know, finding their beloved ones in pain. And what they're calling for now is justice. They want the criminals and those who had blood on their hands, who are those who participated in the killing and torture, to be prosecuted so that they have a closure and they would be able to, say a respectful payoff for their beloved ones.
And Lina, if you could say, you know, there was the, in addition to the Alawite, the protests against the attack on the Alawite shrine, there were also reports of protests after a video went viral on social media of a Christmas tree that was burned. So if you could respond to that, what's known about that and the fact that there's speculation that there were foreigners who were responsible for setting that tree on fire, and who are the foreign fighters now in Syria and where?
Well, there are reports of some foreign fighters who joined the rebels who toppled Bashar al-Assad's regime. And in fact, the HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, who is in charge now, it's the leading force now, they rushed to the scene when the Christmas tree was set on fire, tried to put it down and reassure the families and the Christians who wanted to celebrate that it will be repaired immediately and perpetrators will be arrested. And in fact, they did come back and say that they've arrested them and that they are foreign fighters. And this is a big issue and big challenge because, you know, nobody wants to see foreign fighters here in Syria. However, what happened with the Alawite community is a different story. The when rebels advanced in Aleppo in November, it seems that there was also an attack on Alawite shrine. But there were reconciliation soon after. Suddenly, the videos were released again yesterday, and religious figures from the Alawite community urged people to protest, while at the same time, there was an ambush against HTS security, who are trying to arrest former members of Assad regime who refused to give up their arms. And actually, they shot at HTS and killed 14 members of them. So that happened as the protests also were taking place. But the protests, it seems that, you know, calling for these protests, it had a different agenda behind, because the Alawite community are worried about prosecution. Most of the Alawite community are, you know, supportive of President Assad or former Assad, President Assad, and they had contributed or been part of the crackdown, the brutal crackdown on the Syrians. Arrest, torture, imprison, and killing. So they will be prosecuted, and that's why they are, you know, out and about trying to put pressure so there will be a general amnesty on the Alawite community. This is something that is impossible to happen because the families of those who died in prison, the families of those who were bombed and, you know, tortured to death or disappeared, they need justice. They need answers about what happened to their family members. And there is no way for peace and stability to happen in Syria without, a prosecution, without a legal system that will hold those who have blood on their hands accountable for the sake of reconciliation in the country.
I wanted to ask you about the other protests this week. On Monday, thousands of women gathered to protest to demand that HTS, the new Islamist rulers, respect women's rights. They also condemned attacks on Kurdish-led regions in the north of Syria. But talk about women and what they want as HTS talks about an inclusive government.
Yes, I think they have made their agenda clear that they want an inclusive government, that they will protect the rights of minorities and the rights of women. And I have to say, you know, I'm here in the central of Damascus. Life is just like normal. I mean, I don't need to worry about wearing hijab or even like people. It was Christmas. They were celebrating in parties. They were drinking alcohol. And some HTS members, they were even seen in some of the parties celebrating with other people, while many of them were also also protecting, you know, Christian neighborhoods so that people, Christians, feel safe to have the Christmas mass and celebrate Christmas as well. So I think, you know, that's something that is, you know, unnegotiable about women's rights, about minorities' rights. There are, you know, debates about, you know, this transitional government, because it's all one-colored government, mainly from the Islamists, mainly men who are in charge. So that's also raising some concerns. But civil society is really active. Many initiatives are out talking about involvement in framing the future of Syria, in writing the constitution about participation of all the Syrian society into that. And actually, just 2 days ago, the leadership announced that almost all of the rebel factions dismantled will join the Syrian army. And that's something also very good, because that means that there won't be any internal fighting for power, but they were all under one ministry and one army.
And Lena, finally, as we end, if you could also say, you know, what your concerns are about the different foreign forms of intervention into Syria, from the presence of Iran-backed groups, Turkey, and, of course, these systematic Israeli military airstrikes on Syria.
I think Syria have suffered for more than a decade of different regional powers, you know, deciding for on behalf of Syrians and, you know, having sovereignty over Syrian territories. Mainly we're talking about Iran, Hezbollah and the Russians as well. You know, in the north we've seen also Turkey, you know, supporting some Syrian-backed Syrian forces as well. And Israel has violated almost every right of sovereignty, and especially after the toppling of Assad, almost destroyed all the defense, you know, forces inside Syria. So all of these are violations. And really, as a Syrian, I feel that this is a golden opportunity for Syrians to work together, to build the country together without any interference from foreign forces. But I have to say the most feared one among people here is Iran and its affiliated militia, whether in Iraq or in Lebanon from Hezbollah or the Shiite militias in Iraq. They're worried about them, interfering in the society, causing, you know, disruption and causing instability, especially that many of the Alawites and the Shia in Syria have always been affiliated to foreign powers like in Iran, and they are worried that this is going to continue.
Lena Sanjabi, thank you so much for being with us. Syrian journalist, BBC Middle East correspondent, speaking to us from Damascus, now back in the capital of Syria. She was the BBC Syria correspondent till 2013, when she was forced to flee Syria after threats from the Assad regime. Next up, a new Washington Post investigation reveals 3,100 indigenous students died at boarding schools here in the U.S. from 1828 to 1970, three times more than was reported earlier this year. Stay with us. Honor song for older sister by Pauline Carlo. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with a damning new investigation by The Washington Post, which has determined that more than 3,100 indigenous students died at boarding schools in the United States between 1828 and 1970. That figure is three times the number of deaths reported earlier this year by the U.S. Interior Department. The Post's year-long investigation also found more than 800 students were buried in cemeteries at or near the schools, which were designed to crush Native American culture. Many of the children had been forcibly removed from their families and tribes.
For more, we're joined by the report's lead author, Dana Hedgepeth. She's a Native American journalist who's been at the Washington Post for 25 years, an enrolled member of the Haluasaponi tribe of North Carolina. She co-authored the new investigation headline, More Than 3,100 Students Died at Schools Built to Crush Native American Cultures. She co-wrote the piece with Sari Horwitz, investigative reporter and author of Justice in Indian Country, and also another piece headlined, They Took the Children, The Hidden Legacy of Indian Boarding Schools in the United States. It's great to have you with us. Welcome to Democracy Now, Dina. Why don't you lay out all that you found, and this in the year with the first Native American cabinet member, and they also had come out with a report, but your number was three times more, 3,100 dead children at these schools. Explain what these schools were.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. As you mentioned, we did work here at the Post with an incredible team of journalists. Sari Horwitz, my colleague, is an award-winning journalist here at the Post. We work with a team of data reporters and visual forensics reporters to do our investigation. And as you said, we found that 3,100 Native American, Alaska Native, and Hawaiian Native children died at these boarding schools. These are not what folks think of typically when you think of a boarding school. These are schools that were specifically designed, created with the sole purpose by the U.S. government of eradicating Native American culture and languages for the number one purpose to assimilate them into white society. The schools were started in the 1800s. They ran for a period of about 150 years, and we really dug deep into hundreds of thousands of records to look into what really happened at these schools, what were the conditions, and found that sadly many of these children did not make it home and died at these institutions.
So Dana, could you explain, you know, what brought you to do this investigation in the first place? And, you know, what did these children, more than 3,100 children, what was the cause of death? How did they in fact die?
Very good question. Thank you for asking. First off, for me, I'm Native American. I'm an enrolled member of the Haluasaponi tribe from North Carolina. And as you played in one of your intro pieces, Secretary Holland has said this many a times. Her Assistant Secretary Brian Nolan has said this many times. There's not an indigenous person in this country who doesn't know the story of Indian boarding schools or has been not been impacted by this. These are widely known stories in Indian country. Unfortunately, they are not as known in mainstream press and in society. They've largely been ignored and hidden and just not talked about. So we really wanted to shine a light on this history. As you mentioned, Secretary Holland, kudos to her, because for the first time, she's the only Interior Secretary to shine the light on her own department who ran these very schools. They were started under what was then called the War Department. We now know it as the Pentagon, and then they were put under Interior. So she took huge steps to do a three-year-long investigation looking at these schools, and she found that many of these schools did have mistreat students. They were terribly run, and we expanded upon that work. Again, the Interior Department looked exclusively at federal records. We expanded beyond that, built upon that, and looked at hundreds of thousands of records involving census rolls, school enrollment records, death certificates, historical maps, talking to researchers who had done thesis papers on, for years, worked for 20 years on researching specific schools. We talked to dozens of Indian boarding school survivors who are still alive in their 60s, 70s, and 80s to hear their recollections of these schools.
So how was there such a discrepancy? I mean, clearly, she, the first Native American Interior Secretary, cared deeply about this issue. Why do they come up with 800? You come up with 3,100. And one of the things you looked at were the cemeteries on the grounds. I mean, how many schools in this country are connected to cemeteries?
It's a very good and sad question. Exactly. I have two children of my own, and their schools thankfully don't have cemeteries on their grounds. No school should have a cemetery on its ground. It's a terrible concept to think of. The Interior Department did spend 3 years on their investigation. They produced two reports that dug deeply. Again, she was the first secretary to look into this. It is a very personal issue for Deb Holland. Many of her relatives went to these boarding schools. So it's deeply personal for her. She's of the Pueblo Laguna tribe. She knows this story very well. We took it a step further. They found 973 documented deaths at these Indian boarding schools, and we took it a step further by expanding our base. We looked not just at federal records. We looked at school records. We looked at deep into the work that many researchers had already done. The sins of these schools are not unknown in Indian country. Many great Native American journalists have been writing about this subject for years. We just took upon that work and expanded it to really give it a complete public accounting that it hasn't had before, and to really tell these stories.
So, Dana, could you tell us one of the stories, the one, for instance, that you begin with, Almeida Heavy Hair?
Almeida's story is incredible. It's sad and deep. She's from the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation, about 30 miles from the Canadian border in Montana. And we got to know this tribe through a previous story we had done looking at sexual abuse of about 1,000 children at these schools. That story came out earlier this summer. So this was our second investigation. We kept in touch with Presidents Jeff Stiffarm, Mike Blackwolf, their tribal historic preservation officer there. And we knew that they were going to be attending an exhuming of three of their students who sadly attended Carlisle and died in 1890. Almeida, John Bull, and Bishop Shield were part of 22 students who were taken from their reservation to Carlisle. It still gives me the shivers to think of how we were such an honor to be able to watch their journey as they were exhumed at Carlisle in a very sterile place with these white marble tombstones. Think of a mini Arlington in a way. We watched as those tribal members and 19 of her relatives stood for 2 days and watched them to be exhumed. They sat on traditional buffalo robes. They used ceremonial pipes. They sang. They drummed. They spoke in their own tribal language. These are the very things that those children would have been punished for. They would have been beaten, whipped, food withheld, and they sadly died. Those three children died within 4 years of being at Carlisle. Then as part of the ceremony of bringing them home, they were put in new pine boxes. Their remains, think about this, from 130 years ago, were very carefully exhumed, put in new pine boxes, wrapped in buffalo robes with traditional items, moccasins, earrings for Almeida, and put in these pine boxes and taken in a caravan for a 4-day, 2,000-mile journey back to Montana, where they were buried in their traditional way on a beautiful hillside in their homeland. As John Stiffarm, one of the ceremonial leaders, said, when the army officials who now are in control of the Carlisle property asked him, "Do you want the dirt?" He said, "No, leave that dirt here. They're going to their homeland." You can tell that makes my voice quiver still because it is so powerful in meaning. Everyone across any culture, it's devastating to have your children taken than to watch them be exhumed 130 years later and brought to their homeland. There's nothing more powerful than that. We wanted to tell that story, and Almeida was our way to tell that story.
And Dana, if you could talk about the young boy in 1970. It's not only children, thousands who died at these schools, but those who tried to escape.
That's right. The story of Johnson Key West, who tried to escape to go back home. There were sadly many stories like his, dozens of stories of children who tried to run away from these schools and make it back to their homeland. The thing I'll never forget about his death, sadly, is that on his death certificate, it was marked as frozen. He died trying to get across a mesa, snow-covered hills and mesa back to his homeland. I don't think any of us can really fathom, A, being taken from your home at a young age. Some of these children were as young as 5. Some of them were older teens who stayed at the school because they wanted them to be part of the forced manual labor that these children were required to do at these schools. One of our sources called these not schools, but rather prison camps. They were work camps. They were not meant to educate Native American students to become doctors or lawyers. They were meant to educate them, I say educate with air quotes, educate them in manual labor. Often the students were reported to be 2-3 years behind academically. Some students who survived these schools talk of coming home and having skills that were completely unusable in their communities if they managed to survive them, or just not being able to speak their tribal language anymore and really being out of sorts, having been away from their homes for so long.
Dana Hedgepeth, we only have about a minute left. How has the impact of these schools closed at the beginning of the 70s impacted, what, half a century later?
Wow, that's a good question and a big one. The impact of these schools is still being felt in many ways. As I mentioned, there are several hundred survivors from these schools. They're dealing with the traumas of having gone through these schools, of having been taken away from their tribe, their communities, their families. That has a generational impact on how they raised their children or how they did not know how to raise their children, of grappling with what it means to be away from your home, away from your community, away from your traditions, away from your language. That's left a huge knowledge gap, as we Native Americans call it, in language and in culture. There is a rebuilding of those languages and of those culture traditions, but still it is very, very hard to deal with that trauma. Many Native American survivors are only now beginning to talk about these traumas from decades ago.
We want to thank you for being with us. And unfortunately, we've run out of time, but your work is incredible. And we're going to link to your articles. Dana Hedgepeth, Native American journalist with the Washington Post, member of the Haliwasaponi tribe of North Carolina, 25 years at the Washington Post. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information at CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter.
Beat.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter.
Beat.
Join us every Thursday at 1 on CFRC for your special time with your favorite nuclear family.
My name is Aiden.
And this is Ella.